I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When it comes to Missouri politics, the saga of Eric Greitens has been sucking up a lot of oxygen, but plenty has happened in the General Assembly that doesn't have to do with the governor's alleged misdeeds. Today, political reporters fill us in on the legislature's regularly scheduled session that came to an end on Friday. Then, a provocative view of parts of the country that are between its coasts. We'll speak to two writers and thinkers who spent 5 years traveling across the heart of America in a single-engine prop plane. Deborah and James Fellows join us on Up to Date after this hour's news. Believe it or not, Missouri lawmakers did a few things besides wonder about the latest controversy engulfing Governor Eric Greitens. There were tax cuts and a decision to ask voters to raise the gasoline tax to fund highways. There were decisions on ethics reform and school funding and loosening gun laws. We're going to run all this down right now because there were some big decisions made. With us today, Jason Hancock covers the state capitol for the Kansas City Star. Jason, nice to have you.
Happy to be here.
Brian Howsworth covers the State House for Missouri Net, and as Kyle Palmer just said, the former voice, or maybe the current voice, of the Jeff City Jays. What is it, Brian?
Actually, it'd be the former.
Former voice.
I do the Learfield scoreboards. So that would be three jobs. I can't do that anymore.
You brought Kyle Palmer into the world of professional broadcasting here, right?
Absolutely. That was back in about 2003 and 4, we did Jeff City J games together, but I heard that and really enjoyed it. He's done great, and tell him I said hello.
I sure will. And Jason, I was a bit surprised as I ran through the list of what got accomplished this session, because a lot of significant decisions got made here, despite all the attention devoted to Governor Greitens' struggles. Should I have been surprised?
I mean, some of us were. I mean, the storyline through the session is the governor's legal drama and all the scandals that are engulfing him. Are they going to distract lawmakers from what they were sent to Jeff City to do? And one could make the argument that they did actually did the opposite, that they sort of gave us a focus, both in the media and in the legislature. And if you remember last year, you know, a lot of the drama that surrounded the session was Greitens versus the legislature, kind of turning Republicans against each other in the Senate, made for gridlock, and they didn't get a lot done. This year, there wasn't a lot of infighting. Both the chambers, the Senate and the House, got along really well. They were sort of, there was a lot of noise with the governor, and I don't want to downplay the sort of legal and governmental quandary that he's in right now, but lawmakers were sort of able to focus on their bills and continue to push forward in a way that maybe a lot of us didn't think they could do, but they certainly did. They had a lot of, it's not underselling it to say it was a historic level of accomplishments that they got done this year.
Brian, how big of a trick was this? I mean, do you think for lawmakers to set the controversies around the governor aside to focus on legislation and to make history, to use Jason Hancock's words?
Well, it was historic. I agree with Jason, Steve, in that you had all of this going on and unprecedented about talk about impeaching the governor, and yet they were able to pass a number of bills. If you look at the total amount of bills, there were about 1,510. You know, a few of these get withdrawn, so these are going to be off one or two, but 1,510 House bills, 558 Senate bills for a total of 2,068. And 144, one of those is a resolution passed. So that's about double from last year. That is pretty significant, especially when you consider any sort of tax cut. So a lot of the priorities for the Republicans passed. That said, as Jason knows, I did ask Speaker Richardson on Friday night about his comments. I always look back at what they say at the beginning of session. And in January, his three big things were ethics, labor, and education reform. And they got a lot of those, but they did not get the ethics bill. Justin Alferman's ethics bill came, it just shot out of the House within a week and just died in the Senate. They had it over there by the 15th of January. And the other big defeat for the Speaker this year was charter schools. They brought Jeb Bush in, as you remember, last year That bill passed in the House, died in the Senate. This year, I don't even remember it coming up for a vote or even discussion. So that was a loss as well. But realistically, the Speaker and the Republican majority in the House got most of what they wanted.
You know, Jason, we're often sort of, the media is often criticized for being slow to offer praise, even when it's deserved sometimes. And given that, I'm wondering to what extent do the leaders of the General Assembly deserve credit for what's occurred here? I'm speaking of the Speaker, Todd Richardson, and the Senate President pro tem. His name is Ron Richard.
I mean, they definitely steered the legislature through a tumultuous time. I mean, this thing could have gotten off the rails at any moment. I mean, the governor was indicted twice in the last few months. There was a clamor for him to resign or be forced to out of office through impeachment. And at any point during these last few months, this thing could have gone sideways. There could have been internal revolt. We could have seen a replay of last year where Republicans in the Senate turned on each other and gridlock sort of reigned. But I do think there's a lot of credit that needs to go to Todd Richardson and Ron Richard for keeping their eye on the prize. There was a point in the session where it wasn't looking like they were going to get the signatures to call a special session. And, you know, the Speaker was able to wrangle those signatures in the last couple weeks to call themselves in so that they wouldn't have to deal with it during session, because that would have taken up time that would have pushed a lot of issues off the table, like tax cuts, like tougher regulations on labor unions, a lot of that stuff. There's no way they could have gotten that done and gone through the process of impeachment. So a lot of decisions made over the last few months can be pointed to as why the Republicans had such a successful session.
So, Brian, what do Republicans cite as their top accomplishments here? Just tick off a list, and we'll talk more in depth about some of these things in a few minutes. But what did they cite as the big achievements here?
And it's a direct quote from the Speaker. Tax reform, including tax cuts for personal income tax, corporate tax relief, a balanced budget that fully funds our education formula for the second year in a row. Again, that's a direct quote from Speaker Richardson. He also said that they restored cuts to higher education, made improvements in public safety, and invested in agriculture. So really, it's the Elijah Haar tax cut. It's the balanced budget about the foundation formula that contained a $98 million increase. Those are the things. He said his aim was to make Missouri the most competitive economic environment in the nation. Significant. And kind of focusing on what Jason and you just said, he's right. The thing could have gone off the rails. And remember, the Democrats, even though they're badly outnumbered in the Senate, they could have started a lot more filibusters. They did not. And last year we saw Schaaf do more. We saw some others do more. That didn't happen as much this year. So it seemed to me that while we did have, obviously, on especially on tax cuts and on right to work, yes, it was partisan, right down the party lines, there was a lot more bipartisanship than people realized this session, particularly in the two chambers.
I'm wondering, given that, Jason Hancock, why didn't the Democrats raise a bigger fuss and slow things down, given the fact that they didn't want to see many of these conservative agenda items pass? And secondly, they also wanted to see Governor Greitens impeached sooner rather than later. So what deal with the devil do they make there?
I think a lot of it was get something that they hate now or get something that they absolutely cannot tolerate later. You know, the Republican leaders made it pretty clear that they were open to using procedural maneuvers to cut off debate in the Senate and force through their priorities. And if they did that, they were not going to do that for a compromised bill. So you weren't going to see, for instance, with the prevailing wage law that they passed, they made some significant changes that Democrats hated, but their original proposal was to eliminate the prevailing wage law, you know, with a tax cut. You know, there was some significant changes made through the legislative process. On the next to last day of session, the Senate was given an up or down deal basically from the House, like pass this smaller corporate tax cut or the House will take up and pass an even bigger corporate tax cut and it's your call to make. So I think the Democrats could see the writing on the wall that going into the last session of the legislative leaders, both the Speaker and the President pro tem are termed out, that their negotiating position was not that strong. And even though they wanted to impeach the governor right away, I think they also, even amongst a lot of Democrats, could see it's a process that you don't want to rush into and make mistakes. You don't want to get this wrong. You know, you don't want to take the shot and miss. And so eventually they were talked off the ledge to allow for this process to play out a lot more slowly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the just-completed Missouri legislative session and what was accomplished and what fell short here. Brian Hosworth, let's turn to tax cuts here because I believe this will affect the most people. The legislature voted to cut personal and corporate income taxes, two of the big, you know, items you can cut when it comes to taxes. The state's top personal tax rate will go from 5.9% to 5.1% if certain revenue targets are met. Corporate taxes will decline from 6.25% to 4% in 2020. Why did lawmakers believe more cuts were needed? Because they passed tax cuts a few years ago as well.
Well, under their belief, and this is Elijah Haar and the Republican majority, their belief is that if you cut taxes, revenue will flow into the Treasury and you'll have more money coming in. And that is their argument. They have said that for their legislative careers. They believe Missourians will keep more of their paychecks. And you're right, Steve, but the bill actually reduces the existing individual income tax rate from 5.9 to 5.5, and then there's some additional triggers that are based on revenue growth in there as well. So you're right that it's a little confusing, but as Jason knows, that bill changed so many times. I covered two big hearings on that in March. One was March 5th, and I was there when they voted on it in Ways and Means the next week. That bill was 442 pages, Elijah Haar's bill, and only a small part of it actually dealt with taxes. There was stuff in there about a capital commission, about, you know, fixing up the state capital that was later taken out. There was a big provision in there for transportation about indexing vehicle user fees to the cost of inflation. And touching on, again, what we said, the Democrats on that committee, they knew that they didn't have the votes to stop it. Brandon Ellington, who's from Kansas City, Richard Brown, who's from Kansas City, they knew they couldn't stop it. What they tried to do was protect the circuit breaker for renters. That was their entire focus. They never even talked about the actual bill because they knew the votes were there. They lost on that vote, but Brandon Ellington told me on the record after that he would have voted for the bill to send it to the floor if they would have protected that. He was disgusted he didn't get that because he said, actually, it's going to hurt if they take this away, which they did. He thinks it's going to hurt a lot of the voters in Republican districts. But again, Ellington, in his focus in Ways and Means, and even on the floor, it was primarily about protecting the circuit breaker because they knew in the end the Republicans had the vote to pass a tax cut.
You know, Jason Hancock from The Star, tax cuts cost money. How much will these tax cuts cost the state? And critics say the state can't afford these things.
Well, the cost of these things was actually a pretty contentious point coming down the last couple of days. There was a $60 million error in one of these corporate tax cut bills. You know, there's a fiscal note process that tries to estimate the cost. There was a lot of debate on the House floor because of who knew this mistake was in the bill and when did they know it. It almost derailed the whole corporate tax cut push. Eventually, they were able to sort something out and get a fixed bill. The corporate tax cut bill, if I remember correctly, is going to cost, I think it was in the $30 million, $30 to $40 million range. The income tax bill, they will say it's going to be revenue neutral because they're going to close some deductions for, especially for high income earners, that'll try to offset some of the cuts to the top rate. But you know, if there's a $60 million error in the fiscal note for one bill, I don't know how we can be completely convinced about what the cost is going to be moving forward. Especially a couple years ago, if you recall, they passed a different corporate tax cut bill that was only supposed to cost about $15 million. It's cost us about $200 million since then. So, your guess is as good as mine in a lot of these tax cut bills, and it's going to be something that plays out over the next few years. And you know, it's giving people a lot of heartburn. Even Republican legislative leaders were concerned. They didn't want to leave a mess behind for future legislatures when they're trying to craft a state budget. But at the end of the day, Republican ideology about the value of tax cuts and the potential economic impact were the things that won the day.
So even despite the fact they don't know how much these things are going to cost, Jason Hancock, you're saying they still passed them anyway.
Right. They have fiscal estimates that they believe are accurate. But again, that when you have one debate that says this fiscal impact note was so severely off, and then you're relying on a different fiscal impact note that you're now going to trust, you know, the Democrats were just sort of, you know, screaming bloody murder on the House floor about how can we do this when we're not even confident moving forward that we know how much it's going to impact our budget, when we have had a difficult year talking about how do we fund education? How do we fund our social services? These are debates that are going to play out moving forward. And the hope amongst Republicans is that we will see economic growth based on the income and corporate tax cuts that they just enacted.
Brian, what about school funding? Lawmakers claim that they fully funded the school formula. Are they right?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The Democrats don't necessarily agree with that, but it does. I mean, one thing that is factual, this budget contains a $98 million increase for the foundation formula. The Republicans say, and Speaker Richardson and the Republican leaders say, that this is fully funded for the second year in a row. Brandon Ellington went on the floor and called the House. He said that he called them a joke on the House floor. He said their numbers were off. But Scott Fitzpatrick chastised him. Scott Fitzpatrick's the chairman of the House Budget Committee and said he was wrong. So, again, it depends on who you talk to. One thing that we saw in the conference committee that was, again, different from last year. Last year there was a six-hour budget conference committee I covered. It went all the way to midnight, and it was very contentious. There were heated arguments. Allegations of racism came up last year involving Harris Stowe. And while Harris Stowe did come up again, this year it was much more quiet, much more bipartisan. And Dan Brown got the top priority he wanted, and Scott Fitzpatrick got the top priority he wanted, which was the $98 million increase for K-12, which the Democrats in the House supported. They supported that. So Kip Kendrick got what he wanted there. He wanted that $98 million increase. Of course, he obviously would like to see more. But yeah, it's a $98 million increase for K-12. And the other thing that the Democrats and Republicans, particularly in the House, work together on is to fight off the governor's proposed cuts to higher education. The governor's proposal on that was dead on arrival. It did not have support from either party, and that those cuts were restored.
You know, Jason, it just seems to me, looking over again this list of developments this year, last year, whether it's prevailing wage and supporting legislation on that front, opposing minimum wage increases, union legislation or arguably anti-union legislation, the tax cuts we've talked about, this is an extremely pro-business General Assembly. Am I seeing that accurately?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce would be a big winner this year. Labor unions would be probably the biggest loser if you were going to point somebody out. I mean, they saw not only the prevailing wage get reworked, the Paycheck Protection, which is a bill that deals with public sector unions, public employee unions, and when they have to seek authorization from their members to collect dues. That was passed this year after years of effort and vetoes and wrangling in the Senate. They also moved the unions collect enough signatures to put the right to work repeal on the November ballot. They passed a law, or they passed a bill that will move it to the August ballot in the hopes of improving the chances of defeating it. You know, these are three big historic changes that target labor unions, and it's just a sort of a sign at just how little clout they have left in the legislature. And it'll be interesting to see moving forward how they recover from this, because you're right. It's even if Democrats make gains this fall, there's still going to be a Republican in the governor's mansion, regardless of who that Republican is. And there's still going to be Republican majorities in the House and Senate. I don't know if these historic changes are not going to be rolled back anytime soon. And I think it's sort of we're starting down that road of where labor unions are going to be on the outside looking in.
Brian, what happened on guns?
Well, you know, there were issues that did not get as much attention this year as in previous years. There were a couple of bills that were proposed involving legislation, but Jason, I don't think any of the major ones passed on that this year that I recall.
Is that right?
I don't remember any of those bills getting across the finish line or getting as much attention as they have in other years. So.
Yeah, exactly, because I was at a hearing last year where Jared Taylor had his bill and Nick Schroer, and nothing like that this year.
How about medical marijuana, Jason Hancock?
That got out of the House, and that was kind of a surprise and a big deal. Got over to the Senate and just stalled out. They tried to attach it to a Senate bill, got into conference committee, got pulled out. And so if medical marijuana gets legalized this year in Missouri, it's going to be because voters do it this fall.
What about ending lobbyist gifts, Brian, and this notion that lawmakers get free tickets to sporting events, concerts, you know, liquor, all that kind of thing? What happened to that idea?
It died. It died, and that was something that Speaker Richardson and Gayle Beatty made very clear in their separate press conferences in January would be one of their top priorities. Justin Elferman had a bill that would have banned gifts from lobbyists except for flowers and plants, things like funerals, and any gift that would go to all 197 lawmakers, such as the Taste of Jefferson City event. It passed in January, like I said, around January 15th, 134 to 12, virtually every effect. I think all the Democrats voted for it, but it died in the Senate. It never came up for a vote, very similar to last year. And again, strong support in both parties in the House dies in the Senate. And Gayle Beatty was very disgusted with that when she spoke at the press conference on Friday night. She blamed that on the Senate Republicans.
Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. I want to thank Brian Hawsworth, again, covers the State House for MissouriNet. Jason Hancock covers the state capitol for the Kansas City Star. Gentlemen, thanks for the good update. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it, guys.
Thanks.
Time for a break. When we come back, James and Deborah Fallows join us. They'll talk about their 100,000-mile journey across this country. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we got details on what's likely to come from the Missouri Legislature's special session investigating and possibly impeaching Governor Eric Greitens. You can hear that conversation and many others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, how a new program in Kansas is helping kids in difficult family situations. We'll find out why getting those kids' stress levels down is so important. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, at dinner parties, New York Times columnist David Brooks has been known to ask what he calls the Fallows question. If you could move to a place on Earth where history is most importantly being made right now, where would you go? He named the question after the writers James and Deborah Fallows, who have a penchant for showing up where history is being made. Japan in the 80s, Washington after 9/11, China after that. Today, the Fallows say the most important places to be are towns like Erie, Pennsylvania, Fresno, Sioux Falls, Dodge City, and Garden City, Kansas. Those are among the towns profiled in the Fallows' new travelogue book, Our Towns, the 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. Their journey has brought them right here to our studios today. James Fallows has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly for more than 30 years. He's the author of 10 previous books and a National Book Award winner. James, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Deborah Fallows is the author of Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. Deborah, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
So you two aren't exactly afraid of packing up and hitting the road. It sounds like at a moment's notice. Deborah, there aren't a lot of people out there like you two. At least that's my impression.
For better or worse.
Yeah.
You know, but funny thing about that, I grew up in Ohio, and everywhere we go, I meet people from Ohio. I think there's something about the Midwest where it's a great place to grow up, but it also really keeps your imagination open that you want to see other places.
Well, what gave you the muse this time, James, to venture out into the heart of America?
I think it was a combination of a couple things. We'd been in China, as you mentioned, for quite a while and spent our time there going to the hinterland as much as we could by bus or trolley or horses or whatever. And we thought there was, when we came back to the U.S., it was worth doing that too. Also, we were back here in sort of the teeth of the big recession of 08, 09 and the aftermath of that. And we wanted to know how at this sort of granular level American society was dealing with that. We knew the capital city rhetoric and just the sort of bitterness of that. But we wanted to know places where people were having their communities and their businesses changed, what was the response?
Hmm. How did you decide where to go, Deborah?
We knew we wanted to go to smaller and medium-sized towns, the kind of towns you don't normally hear from in the national media. And also, we grew up in small towns, so that resonated with us. And we wanted to go to towns that might have some kind of narrative or story to tell about themselves. Jim posted a piece on his blog at The Atlantic saying we're about to launch into this, and tell us a story of your town if you're interested. And within about a week, we had 1,000 responses.
No kidding.
From all across the country, and everything from just come to my town to full-blown essays about why their town is interesting and why we should go there. So we just started out.
You know, this was not exactly like Travels with Charlie, you know, Jim. you know, he was in a little camper. You guys flew in a single-engine airplane across the country. What was the advantage to seeing America from that vantage point?
There's an aesthetic advantage. You just see the world. I know some of the listening audience here will include pilots. You see the world from 2,500 feet in a way you cannot any other means. If you're driving around, you're seeing the world from 6 feet elevation. Yes. It looks like it's all road. From an airliner, you can't really see anything. But from 2,500 feet, it is like being God. You can see how the rivers shape where the cities are and how the sort of how the shift in the precipitation levels changes as you're coming westward across the continent. So it was aesthetically pleasing but also practically important because basically any place in the U.S. is within 10 or 15 miles of a small airport. So we went to places that would have been difficult to get to, impossible by commercial aviation and difficult on the interstates.
That's interesting. Well, if a single-engine airplane sounds a little shaky, I should point out, Deborah, there's a parachute attachment in the back of this plane. How does that work if all heck breaks loose?
Right. Well, this is a Cirrus SR-22, now the most popular small general aviation plane that is built in America. And if Jim gets bonked on the head, there is a lever that I can pull down, which deploys a parachute for the entire plane, like the old balsa wood planes that you had when you were a kid, where they settle down. This is not something you do lightly. It's only under extreme emergency. We haven't had the opportunity to do it, but it's incredibly reassuring to know that it's there.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
It changes things, right?
It does, and it has changed things. There have been how many, Jim?
Yeah, about 70. In the 20 years the plane has existed, there's now about 7,000 around the world. About 70 deployments have occurred, and everybody has walked away.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It's
true. I mean, because the alternative in almost all these cases would have been just a crash. So small plane aviation is dangerous. It's safer if you do it in good weather, which we do. And the parachute is a bonus factor.
Well, tell us about a place or two that you visited that absolutely delighted you, Deborah, as you think back of your trip and all the different spots. What are the first one or two places that you tell people about what you came across that maybe you didn't expect?
So these are two very small communities that are opposite ends of the country. Eastport, Maine is about as far down east as you can possibly get. Takes a really long time to drive there. But flying from Portland is just maybe an hour or so. It's right across the sound from Campobello Island. Mm-hmm. Tiny town of about 2,400 people where everybody has to pitch in to make things work. For example, we went to an evening performance of The Glass Menagerie at the local theater and found out later that the person taking tickets was also the editor of the newspaper.
Oh,
the woman
kidding.
Who was the stage manager was also the barista and the nephrologist at the clinic, and she had opened up a new kennel. So the inspiration from an entire town struggling to remake itself after losses in the fishing industry, they have great plans for their harbor, but they also all participate. The other town is at the opposite end of the country and surprisingly similar in its gumption, Ajo, Arizona, in southwest Arizona, in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. 1,400 people who are struggling to remake that town after the copper mine closed, and doing it on the basis of the arts, and eventually they hope some tourism. But again, a real participatory place.
You know, what struck me about your book, and maybe one of the main points here, is that one of your conclusions, James, is that these towns you visited face big problems. Everybody does. But they're also crafting solutions to navigate all this. And this was way more upbeat message than a lot of people might expect after 100,000 miles on the road. How surprised were you to find out what you found out?
We were surprised. And I think that's the reason we finally wrote this book. After we'd been to a couple of dozen towns for a couple of weeks each, so we felt as if we had more than just a one-day exposure there, or more than just sitting in the diner with somebody saying, you know, what's going on here. We had the sense that almost every place people felt that the U.S. as a whole was in trouble and that the trends were negative, but they felt as if the part of America that was within their direct experience – they were making some progress, that they had, you know, the opioid situation is a disaster across the country. Economic dislocation is, of course, important and profound, but most people, most places felt as if the movement was in the positive rather than the negative direction, which is the main message we want to convey.
I mean, that's kind of an amazing thing, given all the problems the country's facing. And again, you wouldn't have expected that maybe when you walked in the door here today.
We would not have expected it when we first went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota 5 years ago. And I think the reason this message matters for the U.S. right now is we all know the things that don't work at a national level, and regardless of your political orientation, you don't feel very good about national politics, and the ability to match the great resources the U.S. still has to the great problems the U.S. has. But being aware that across the country there are people who are rebuilding their downtowns, reviving their libraries, reconfiguring their high schools to train people for the tech jobs that do exist now, mm-hmm. this, I think, should give people more confidence that the next wave of American renewal is actually already underway.
Is this the same phenomenon, Deborah, this idea that everybody hates Congress, but you sort of like your local congressman, I mean, or woman for that matter? Is it that idea?
I think it is exactly that idea. And we heard resonance of that in just about every town we met. And I think part of the reason is that people have an idea that they can have an effect in small towns. You know, they may not be able to do anything, even affect their congressman or their senator. But if you walk out the door every day in your small town or medium-sized town, you have much more control, and you can apply your efforts where they'll have an impact locally.
Yeah. But when you started off on your journey, it doesn't sound like this was the bottom line that you envisioned as you started off. Or did you have something you were expecting when you started off?
No, I mean, we knew what everybody else knew was that the national narrative was not good. We went off wondering what we would find, and having still had a lot of contacts with our own small towns where we grew up, we had a sense that things were going okay there. So were those anomalies, or was that what it was like in the rest of the country?
Yeah. And you know, my credo as a journalist, as you will understand, is that reporting is finding out what you didn't know until you showed up.
Yeah.
And so by showing up in little places in China, every time we just learned something we hadn't anticipated. So we wanted to go through that same process here.
James and Deborah Fowles are my guests. Their new book, Our Towns, The 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. It'll be hitting the New York Times bestseller list in another week or two here. I should point out the two of them will be appearing at 6:30 this evening at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street in downtown Kansas City. This is a Rainy Day Books author event. Registration is required at kclibrary.org. You know, James, I'm wondering what kinds of solutions you found to the various problems that you set off and found here. I was struck by your visit to Dodge City, Kansas, and how that town is assimilating all the Latinos that it is. Is this one example of a solution that you found out there?
Yes.
Again, this is counterintuitive, at least in the minds of a lot of people here.
I think there were two areas where the contrast between national rhetoric and local reality was particularly stark. One was on the issue of immigration and ethnic adjustment. My view of the long history of American immigration policy is that it's never been completely trouble-free with the Germans or the Irish or the Italians or the Greeks or anybody, but the process has gone on. And the national rhetoric suggests that's not the case, but city by city, including in western Kansas, where most of the city is now majority Latino, you found efforts to involve the new citizens of the town. We quote in the book a number of politically conservative white Anglo residents of Dodge City who say, this is the future of our town. These children are the ones who will be keeping our town alive. And so they've passed bond issues to increase funding for the public schools where the students are mainly Latino in the face of state-level budget cutbacks, of course, in Kansas. The other, I think, contrast would be in education, where generally the view is, oh, American education in crisis. City by city, we found just really heartening experimentation, and let's find ways to train people whose parents would have worked in giant factories that don't exist anymore, but train these people for jobs as welders where the wages are very high, or in the wind power industry, which is just growing across the country, including western Kansas.
You know, is this embrace of Latinos in Dodge City, should should that undermine my sort of enthusiasm for that notion? Because there's an economic driver here, it seems to me, that's underpinning this embrace of people who look different than the longtime residents of Dodge City, Kansas.
I think there probably has to be an economic underpinning because refugees and immigrants need to become full-fledged, productive citizens to do well here. And we have found across the country that a number of the towns we've been to, Erie, Pennsylvania, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Burlington, Vermont, Dodge City, are places where there are good employment opportunities for these newcomers. And then they quickly give back and revive the community too by buying cars, renting homes, buying homes, starting their own businesses. That is a classic case in Erie, Pennsylvania, that the refugees there are now, having come with nothing, a very strong and vital part of the recovering economy of Erie.
I was going to say the fact there are jobs available and a need for those for people certainly helps.
Yes, and that's been the pattern of American immigration through history. You know, immigrants go where the opportunities are and businesses arise that can use their efforts. But it's really striking across the Rust Belt. Many of these cities say their main source of just demographic vitality of young people and also entrepreneurial activity is largely refugees and immigrants. So we saw that in Erie and across Ohio and in Pennsylvania too.
Yeah, one thing that has struck me about the Dodge City story, and again, I hope my history is correct, is that the embrace of Latinos began early on. This was not something that sort of was, there were struggles for a while and then a grudging acceptance. This sort of just, it started organically right out of the gate.
And I think, there's a long history of Western Kansas where in the cattle drive era and the railroads and all the rest, there were diverse populations working in those industries too. But in the last generation, as meatpacking has become such a big industry there, and mainly Latino immigrants have come to work there, including some Africans too, I think there's been a recognition by the city that this is the deal which will allow the city to survive and grow.
Yes. Yeah.
And in the school system, there's a migrant student office, which is doing a tremendous amount of work to settle the migrants into Kansas City. In fact, Robert Vinton, who is the head, Bobby Vinton, you could call him, but his name is actually Robert Vinton, is the head of that office, says that Dodge City is a first point of entry, port of entry for such a big influx of Latin Americans now into Dodge City. And they work with the schools, they work with the libraries, they work with the social services, they pay home visits. They work very hard to make sure that the transition is as productive as possible.
And is the mingling of the different backgrounds, is it working? Do you see it as you get around town?
You see it from town to town. You hear it. You hear the residents of the town and the immigrants saying, "We need each other." You see it. I saw it at the big public swimming pool, the new one in Dodge City, where there was a swimming team full of all kinds of kids, and they didn't segregate themselves. They were just mixing and mingling. Same thing at the public library. There was a Wichita science group that was paying a visit during the summer. 200 kids in the Dodge City Library getting science lessons, and their monitors were the junior high, the middle school kids from the system, from the DC Dodge City Public Schools, who were helping out at this. And there were all colors, there were all races, there were all ages, there were all demographics. And I think I would say that the more there are, the more they mix and mingle.
That's just
in the
amazing
halls of school.
Again, James and Deborah Fallows are my guests. We're talking about their new book, their journey across America, Our Towns, the 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. Another solution, Jim, if you will, the flexibility demonstrated in a town like Spurville, Kansas, near Dodge City. Their farmers have capitalized on a natural asset that anyone who has visited Western Kansas lately will recognize, and that's the wind. What's happening out there when it comes to harnessing the wind?
So this is incredible. This is a town just east of Dodge City, which is spelled, I would have said Spearville from
yes,
its name.
Yes, I would have too.
They say Spurville, and it's mainly farmland. You see just these acres and acres of mainly wheat at the time when we were there. But in the wheat, which is a couple feet high, we have these wind turbines a couple hundred feet high, and it just has revolutionized the town. And again, a politically very conservative town, the normal grid, is just so excited about the wind energy business because it's creating jobs. There are revenues for the landowners and the farmers who have this extra, revenues coming in from their fields.
Farmers can diversify for once in a way they haven't been able to for a long time.
And the town, we were driving around seeing the new school, auditorium and swimming pool, the new city hall, the newly paved roads from the royalties from these wind turbines. So we have not met more enthusiastic people about the sustainable energy revolution than we saw in western Kansas around the town of Spurville.
That's really interesting. I'm wondering, what could the federal government be doing to be more helpful to these communities? Because you do get a sense in the recent history of this country is the federal government pulling back as opposed to offering more. What's your sense?
We saw across the country signs of what the federal government had done in the past when it was really involved. For example, it's just amazing how much of the public architecture of the U.S. in this century was laid down in 3 or 4 years in the 1930s by the
WPA.
During
the Great Depression and all the help that the federal government was doing.
And we know what the federal government has done in farming and everything else. I think that most places we went, there was awareness of retreat by the federal government, so people being forced to turn in more on their own resources. But to the extent the federal and state governments can give incentives for things these communities want to do in diversifying their educational programs or building more public spaces which really matter, the river walks and the just public arts, I was skeptical of that, but it actually makes a difference in how these Dodge City has its great statuary of sort of the trail rider Gunsmoke business. So I think if the federal government at some point can give more grants for downtown renovation, for affordable housing, for settling and absorbing immigrants, all those things help.
But you're also making a case that how much of that is really needed. Are communities able to do it on their own?
I think most of the communities we went to assumed they would have to do it on their own. They would like to have some support, but they felt that this was the hand they were dealt for now.
And there's still a list of things they'd like to do. There's always more.
Yeah. And you get a sense, too, that you guys conclude that these communities are pushing ahead despite the gridlock in Washington. And some might argue this is exactly the way things are supposed to work.
No one's waiting around. People in these towns know that if something's going to happen, it's going to have to start there, and that they know very well what their towns need most and want most. So it's a beginning place, and again, they feel like they can have an impact today, tomorrow, next year, not waiting for whatever might happen politically.
Yeah. James, you point out that America is missing the boat in one sense because we've demonstrated time and time again that we can rally during times of war and this country can do almost anything at that point. But in times of peace, we tend to slump and we let opportunities get away from us a little bit.
The most important essay in American political history is one in 1910 by William James called The Moral Equivalent of War.
I'd never heard of it until I read it in your book.
And he was looking back on the Civil War when he had been a young man, saying that for the Americans of that generation, it was the worst experience in American history, but it brought out the best in many individuals and in their ability to sacrifice and plan and all that. So his question, which is the enduring question for the U.S., is how we have the moral equivalent of what war can do, of how you can mobilize people to some great cause without having them kill each other. Mm-hmm. The Peace Corps might have been one example of that a generation ago. Other ways in which people can think there's a larger cause they are part of. That happened in the early 20th century with the progressive and populist movement. We're hoping that some sense of American reform is growing up city by city now.
And again, the point of your book would suggest that that's exactly what's happening. We're doing it despite the lack of war, and we're seeing progress being made at a level you hadn't anticipated.
That was the surprise to us of traveling around. We hope it'll be a surprise to readers and people who hear about this, and we hope it'll be an encouraging surprise of making them think something is starting, and that's where these seeds can be watered and nourished and grow into something more substantial.
Are you seeing more civic engagement out there? Because, again, we're coming out of this bowling alone generation, people not engaging in their communities and in a very substantial way. And did you see something else out there, Deborah?
I would say we saw almost a tsunami of civic engagement, and people are really finding their ways through their different passions, whether it's in the public arts, embedding artists in residence with the local governance.
Yeah.
In the school systems, where, well, you see this nationally, kids speaking out on issues that are of critical importance to them, from Parkland, Florida,
right,
through Texas, and teachers in Oklahoma and other places. You certainly see it in the public libraries that are developing all kinds of civic engagement projects, whether it's pushing journalism or having citizenship classes or ESL classes or connecting with the schools, supporting the teachers. You see it in on-the-ground public arts, where the arts groups are supporting their local artists and giving us, through that, I think, giving a sense to the residents of the town, this is who we are, this is how we define ourselves, look at what we've built here, look at these statues. We are the gateway to Mount Rushmore or to the Wild West.
Ultimately, this is America the rest of the country isn't aware of. You're painting a picture of America that would shock a lot of people in Washington, D.C., Jim.
And it has shocked them. Whenever we talk to our friends in D.C., they roll their eyes and say, oh, you've gone native with the heartland. And as you well know here, and your audience too, there's much of America that is covered only when there's a disaster, mm-hmm, or there's a political campaign, or there's some set piece idea of let's go out and see how they're dealing with meth or how they're dealing,
yes,
with opioids.
Right.
As opposed to treating the entirety of America in its three-dimensional reality. And that's what we tried to see and convey.
Another trait of winning communities that you talk about in here, James, the phrase public-private partnership refers to something real, meaning?
Meaning a bridge, a public park, a program like the ones we saw in Greenville, South Carolina, something called the Elementary School of Engineering, a public school in a rough neighborhood where engineers from Michelin and GE and BMW teach these little kids who are 6 and 7 and 8 years old how to become engineers. So things like that. The phrase, I used to think it stood for nothing. It was just kind of bombast, public-private partnership. But we've seen 50 illustrations of a tangible thing that it means.
That's amazing. Again, James and Deborah Fowles, their new book, Our Towns, The 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. You can see and hear them this evening at 6:30 at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library, 14 West 10th Street, downtown. This is a Rainy Day Books author event. Registration required at kclibrary.org. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Interesting story.
Steve.
You bet.
Thank you.
On Friday's show, the film critics reviewed the latest independent movies. You can hear that and other conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we talk with two young women from Kansas and Missouri who made news by breaking their silence about sexual assaults. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.